You're listening to Critical Reads. This show is designed to help people critically analyze topics like race, culture, and faith, one resource at a time. I am your host, Neff Lesperance. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of Critical Reads. As the intro says, I'm your host, Neff, and I thank you so much again for joining us. And if you're new to the show, welcome. I'm super excited to dive into our episode today, where we'll be talking about a book that's entitled Dimensions of Social Welfare Policy. But before we get into that, I do want to acknowledge that I know the past week was a holiday. I didn't necessarily acknowledge it in the first few episodes that I dropped, but I just wanted to just take some time and wish you all happy holidays. I know we're going to be jumping into all the different things that are coming up with, like Christmas, you know, Advent, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah. There's just so many holidays that are coming up. And so as we start winding into all of those and, you know, spending time with family, I do really wish that you all are having a safe holiday and, you know, just having some good times with your family. And I pray that we are actually using this time to just connect and regroup, refresh ourselves for the new year. Even though I know for me, this has felt like 2020 part two in some ways. It's nice to see that, you know, there are some moments of joy and things that can come up regardless of all the sad shit too that's been around. So yeah, there's that. And I also wanted to acknowledge that I know today I'm dropping this episode on Saturday instead of Friday, and I will discuss more about why in a little bit, but I just wanted to acknowledge that, you know, given my schedule, given the fact that I live at home again, that may happen, but just know that I will do my best to, you know, drop it either Friday or Saturday. And when I can't, you'll know, because I'll, you know, maybe post it on Instagram or just let you guys know what's going on. Because at the end of the day, I think as much as I love to create this content, I'm also being kind to myself and saying, hey, if I can't do it 1 week because life is crazy or something's going on, I'm going to honor that and practice taking some time to rest and not feeling the pressure of just having to post stuff just to post stuff. So yeah, like I said, I'll warn you guys if there's something that comes up and I was like, hey, I can't drop anything this week. But for the most part, Friday or Saturday, I'll try to drop something. And, you know, hopefully it could be another resource that you guys will be willing to dive into and enjoy and actually gain a lot from. So with that said, we're going to start this episode like we normally do by going into the segment that I like to call Musings of a Tired Black Social Worker. And so with this segment, it's just basically a time where I just reflect on something that is either interesting to me or that has caught my attention or has just been on my mind this week. And so for me, that has been the topic or the concept of compassion fatigue. And so very briefly, for those of you who are not familiar with the term compassion fatigue, this basically is a term that kind of describes the physical, emotional, and psychological impact of helping others. And this is often seen through experiences of stress or trauma. And the reason that this topic has been on my mind lately is because I know for me, I work as a social worker. And because I'm in a profession that usually requires a lot of caregiving and helping other people and trying to like heal them, quote unquote, there's a lot of times where I notice that I'm triggered and I'm starting to experience different aspects of compassion fatigue. And I have to be willing to like kind of sit with that and address it. And so for me, it's been on my mind a lot because obviously, I don't know if I've shared before, I think I have, but right now I'm working in an inpatient facility in this hospital where I'm working with patients who are often at risk of like either hurting themselves, hurting others, or are like actively going through a state of psychosis, and we're like kind of helping them stabilize. And even though there's a lot of parts of the work that's very exciting, there's a lot of parts of the work that in some ways can give me life, and I get opportunities to really help people get better. There's also parts of the work that can be very excessive and demands. It has a lot of long hours sometimes, and sometimes it could just be very heavy. I'm not just in the workload, but just the content that I'm having to consume, whether it's from the stories that my clients are telling me, or stories that their family members or people that they care about that are giving us information are telling us. And so I think, you know, the reason compassion fatigue has been on my mind considering all of this, these different things, is because I think oftentimes I notice, you know, as a person that's working in social work, there's not always a lot of space for people like me in my profession to have others around us really understand where we're coming from or understand how exhausting the work can be. And I know there are some people like me that maybe have some friends and other social supports that kind of help them with coping, but I know there's other people too that they basically go home and they enter spaces that can often be even more toxic or as toxic and really contribute more to why they're exhausted. And so for me, I know I do have like a pretty good family, but at the same time, I'm the only person in my family, especially my immediate family, that has gone to therapy and is willing to do the work of, you know, gaining emotional intelligence, learning how to, you know, do conflict well, et cetera, et cetera. And so because I am that person, I notice like my compassion fatigue sometimes just becomes bigger and it's a lot more difficult to manage because not only am I exhausted at work, but then when I come home, I feel like there's some times where I'm playing social worker at home because I'm trying to get a bunch of other grown adults to like work together and talk things out and deal with conflict in a healthy way and all this stuff. And at the end of the day, I recognize that it's not my responsibility, but I think because I work in a field where, like I said, you're constantly helping and healing, it's hard sometimes to be mindful about turning that shit off and saying, okay, this is my day off, or this is my time that I can have to myself, and I'm not gonna get dragged into the, you know? And then I think to add to that, it is even harder to, you know, add boundaries sometimes when you're living with a family full of immigrants. So for me, because I'm Haitian and all of us are immigrants, Haitians don't really do a good job of having boundaries, you know? And I think there's other people that are like that as well. So I'm not just saying that it's just Haitians and all Haitians, but I just know, like, as an immigrant family, I don't think, you know, we do so great at like having boundaries and not seeing somebody else saying like, hey, I don't like when you do X, Y, and Z as disrespect, you know? And so I think that's where it's such an interesting dynamic to try to figure out, especially again, like as a social worker, how to, you know, share my views, try to make sure that my boundaries are being honored, but then also getting hit with this backlash of you're being disrespectful, you're not listening to me, you're not honoring your parent, etc. So yeah, so that's why this topic has been so like near and dear to me this week, because, you know, of course I'm trying to navigate again, being back home, working in a job that's very stressful, trying to create ways to care for myself. And then again, we only have 24 hours in a day. So, and at least like ideally 8 of those you're supposed to be sleeping. And I know another 8 of those I'm working at least during the week, right? So yeah, it's very hard to balance all that. So I do want us to be mindful, though, as we are, you know, moving forward and just like learning together, like the fact that compassion fatigue does exist. And so whether or not you work in the fields where you're helping people all the time, or you know somebody that is working in those fields, I just think it's so important for us to take the time to understand that compassion fatigue is real, that people are constantly being triggered by the work that they're doing, and that we need to take time to like really notice the signs and see how we can help other people who are in those professions just you know, move forward in life and, you know, even challenge them to take care of themselves, you know? And so I'm not going to read all the triggers. I'm going to post a resource about this, but, you know, some of the triggers that is good to notice is that if you're a person that, you know, you're working in a space where you're constantly physically or verbally threatened, but when you're providing care, if you're working in a place that maybe is in a dangerous environment. So for example, I know for me, since I do work in inpatient and sometimes our patients are psychotic, we're constantly having to be in alert for the fact that a patient can, you know, try to grab my hair, for example, or try to hit me. They can be violent, even if they're not provoked. So we have to be on high alert. So that's one example. And again, like I mentioned, you can notice that a trigger could be heavy workloads, excessive demands, long hours, maybe providing service that kind of requires you to visit accident scenes a lot or see graphic evidence or deal with evidence that reports a lot of trauma. So I think an example for that would be like, you know, people that work as cops or medics or EMTs. I think sometimes even like nurses, honestly, and doctors. So again, so those can be some of the triggers. And then when we move on to some of the signs, again, I'm just going to name a few. Like some of that can look like maybe you're noticing that the person or you are dealing with a lot of mood swings where you're noticing there's like drastic shifts in your mood, or like sometimes you're realizing that you're becoming a little bit more irritable or more pessimistic over time. Sometimes you kind of experience this sense of detachment where you're like dramatically withdrawing from social connections. I know for me, when I'm super stressed out or I am really dealing a lot with compassion fatigue, one of the biggest ways that you can tell is I stop engaging in social media. I stop engaging in text messages. I stop, you know, wanting to hang out with friends, and like you can find me in my room, like just hanging out and not talking to anybody. And maybe I'm watching a movie or listening to an audiobook or whatever, but I'm just completely emotionally withdrawing from people, which sometimes I think that can be a good thing because, like, I know, for example, as an introvert, I recharge that way, but it's being mindful that when you're withdrawing, that you're not doing it for so long that it's like, you know, it becomes like evidence of you're depressed, you know, which again, those can also be signs. Sometimes you deal with a lot of depression and anxiety as a result to compassion fatigue. And so, yeah, again, like I said, I'm going to post a resource that explains this a lot more and kind of gives you a little bit of more insight on this topic. But the reason why I think, again, this is important to talk about is, especially given what happened this past year with COVID, and well, it's almost like the past 2 years with COVID, I think there's so much fatigue that's happening for people that are in the helping and healing fields, including, I would even say, teachers. But we have like nurses, social workers, doctors, therapists, EMTs, sometimes legal, all these different places that they're just constantly being exposed to death, constantly trying to help people grieve. Maybe they themselves had to have somebody in their family have that as well while they're working with patients, you know, that are, have these things going on. And so again, just being mindful that this is a reality that a lot of people have to deal with in their day-to-day job. And also just being willing to show compassion and kindness and remind those people like, hey, you deserve a break. You deserve some time off, and not to be afraid to do that. And you know, I know for me, I'm really thankful that I have a good community outside of my family, because sometimes my family isn't safe. So like having a good community outside of my family where, you know, I have a friend, for example, Stephanie, who's like, hey, are you taking your time off? Are you resting? Like every once in a while, she'll check in and ask me about those things because she knows like how much I take in so much crap and how much I do so much sometimes that I don't always do a good job of like caring for myself. And so, you know, Stephanie's like one example, but again, like I'm thankful for people like her who are like noticing how stressful my job is. And they're like, hey, are you taking care of yourself? Are you taking time off? Are you working out? Are you doing whatever, you know? And then another great resource for that stuff too is obviously going to a therapist and seeing somebody professionally to help you process, if whether it is like you've had to deal with traumatic imagery, you just feel stressed out in general about work. I know for me, it's been very helpful in my field to just have some space and some time to be like, hey, every week at this time, we're going to talk and process how crazy things have been and make sure that I still am practicing the safety things that I need to do or the self-care things that I need to do to make sure that I'm coping with everything well, you know? And again, even with that, it's not like we're going to cope with everything well all the time, right? But at least with when you have a good support system through like a therapist and your friends, you know, and even family, it can help you be redirected during the times that you're just not dealing with things well, right? Or that you're maybe adding unhealthy coping mechanisms into your patterns, right? And so, yeah. So again, that's something that has been just heavy on my mind this week, especially given that I said, you know, like I plan to post these things on Friday, but this week was just so nuts that I had to realistically look at my schedule at work, look at the obligations and things that I have going on at home, and just give myself the space to be like, you know what, Neff, like this week ain't it, and that's okay, you know? And I think we need to be more willing to do that, especially given our society is very driven by, are you producing? Are you showing up? Are you doing X, Y, and Z? But we don't always value the rest. We don't always value getting help or asking for help. And so I think that's a perfect kind of like segue into talking about the book that we're doing today, because it does talk a little bit about some of the helps and things that, you know, could be helpful to our society, if especially when we talk about the welfare of our country. But I know like this topic is such a heated political thing a lot of the times that it's hard to really have a fair and honest, unbiased conversation about this. And so my goal today by bringing up this book is just to kind of give some background and some insight again into like some of the ways that I think and why I think the way that I do, because I think having some exposure to this book when I first started my journey into becoming a social worker really helped lay some of the groundwork for why social work exists and why we try to do the things that we do. And again, I will say like I'm not here bringing up this book to change anybody's mind or anything like that, but I often, you know, think and feel that when we're having conversations about policy and social welfare and just, you know, programs from the government and all these different things, a lot of times we have these debates and these arguments without fully understanding what definitions mean or what these policies mean in the long run, or even like that we are going to be biased towards certain things. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring up this book, just to kind of, again, lay down some of the groundwork for why we need to deconstruct and why it's important to understand how our country is designed and why it's designed the way that it is and why it's important for us to think about making some changes and hopefully having a more, you know, inclusive and inform conversations about policy and social welfare. So with that said, let's dive into this book a little bit. So like I mentioned, the book that we're going to be talking about today is called Dimensions of Social Welfare Policy. And apparently there's, you know, a few editions of this, obviously, because it is kind of like a textbook that people often use to teach social work students about welfare policy. So for this episode, I happen to be using the one that's an 8th edition. So I don't know if they're going to eventually create a 9th edition, but I wouldn't be surprised. So we'll keep that in mind. And this book was written by two authors, one named Neil Gilbert and the other one named Paul Terrell. And just to give a little bit of a summary of the book, the authors in the back wrote, Dimensions of Social Welfare Policy provides a comprehensive and widely used framework for analyzing social welfare policies. The text encourages readers to develop their own thoughts on social welfare policy and explore policy alternatives. theoretical points are illustrated with examples from a cross-section of program areas including income maintenance, child welfare, model cities, daycare, community action, and mental health. The text familiarizes students with the content of major social welfare programs such as TANF, OASDHI, SSI, and Title XX. Obviously, these are all acronyms that the book explains, but I'm not going to focus too much on these, but just know that, again, these are social welfare policies. And so the learning goals for this book, they say, upon completing this book, readers will be able to understand current policy issues, reflect on where they stand in regard to these controversial policy issues, understand major social welfare programs, and also better understand CSWE's core competencies and practice behaviors. And CSWE is basically part of, it's an accreditation system or whatever for social work. So I will say that this book and, you know, a lot of the things that we do in this country are full of acronyms. So if you do read this book, bear with that. But for the most part, they explain everything, all the acronyms. And so moving forward, well, we can talk a little bit about the authors. So obviously, like I said, there's Neil Gilbert and Paul Terrell. So with Neil Gilbert, he's a professor of social welfare at the University of California, Berkeley, and the co-director of the Center for Child and Youth Policy. His publications include 30 books and over 100 articles. Several of his books have been translated into Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and Italian. His work, Capitalism and the Welfare State by Yale University Press, was a New York Times notable book. His most recent book, A Mother's Work, How Feminism, the Market, and Policy Shape Family Life, was a society notable book and Atlantic Monthly selection. Gilbert served as a senior research fellow for the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development in Geneva. He was twice awarded the Fulbright Fellowship to study European social policy as a visiting scholar at London School of Economics and at the University of Stockholm. He has also served as a visiting scholar at the International Social Security Association in Geneva. So that's Neil's background. And then when we look at Paul, he's also a lecturer at the School of Social Welfare and University of California, Berkeley, where he has also served as the coordinator of academic programs. He has recently taught at the School of Social Development and Social Policy at Beijing Normal University. That's in Beijing, obviously. Terrell served as research coordinator, Proposition 13 Monitoring Project, National Association of Social Workers, and was associate director, Regional Research Institute in Social Welfare at the University of Southern California. He has co-authored The Social Impact of Revenue Sharing, Planning, Participation, and the Purchase of Service by Prager Publishers and Social Services Contracting in the Bay Area by the Institute of Governmental Studies by UC Berkeley. His articles include Studies of Advocacy in Social Work, Financing Social Work Services, and Privatization. So, all of this is a mouthful, and obviously, from the time that this book was, you know, put together, created, published, and all that stuff, obviously, these writers have probably done a lot more than what is written in their little bios, especially given that this book was published in 2012, right? So I'm sure they've done a lot more since then. But the key takeaways here is that these men have dedicated a lot of time and energy to the study of social welfare and social welfare policy. They've traveled different parts of the country or the world also to kind of, you know, learn more about these topics as they've been writing. And so, again, I think it's important to note that when we read some of these resources, it's like, where the hell are these people coming from when they're talking about this? Do they have the background? Do they know what they're talking about? And obviously, again, with all of these different authors, there might be moments where they might miss something, obviously, because of their background or where they are in life, especially, you know, let's say if they're straight men, they might not understand the plight of people who are in the LGBTQ community when they're talking about this stuff, or they obviously they're not going to understand everything about women. There's going to be some things that they miss, but at the end of the day, they both have a background in social welfare and in social welfare policy. So as they're bringing up this topic of conversation, they're obviously coming here with a bunch of knowledge that they've dedicated their time and their energy to. I don't know if the word would be perfecting, but because I don't know if you can really perfect it, but maybe the word is just that they've dedicate a lot of, you know, time and energy to become as knowledgeable as they can on the topic, with the understanding that a lot of this stuff will change as, you know, time and society changes as well, right? So very briefly, what made me choose this book? So obviously, like I said, as a social work student, a lot of universities recommend reading books like this just so that we can have an understanding of policy, especially given that a lot of the work that we do as social workers, it's highly affected by what policies are currently on the table, what policies need to be amended or changed, what policies need to be taken away altogether. Basically, policy determines a lot of the work that we can and cannot do, right? And so because this was a textbook for my college class, obviously I was required to read it. But I will say that as a person who wasn't born in this country, I found this book to be very helpful because it really helped me kind of have more of a frame of like how this country was designed and what forces kind of play a role in the background to kind of make all the different policies and the different laws and regulations and all these different things happen. And obviously the authors can only do so much. Like, they're not, you know, going to be able to capture everything, but it really gave me some, you know, things here and there to really think about, reflect on. And later I was able to, you know, take stuff away from this book to kind of catapult me into learning about other things surrounding these different policies, right? So that's in short why I chose to read this book and bring it up. The cool thing about this book is that, you know, the author's goal is to kind of help people who read it develop a kind of operational understanding of social welfare policy. And I think the word operational here is very important because from what I can glean from this book and from their goals in creating this book, I think they choose to go by creating a operational definition because they understand that when we talk about social welfare and social welfare policy, it's kind of hard to really come together and be like, this is the agreed upon definition for this. You know what I mean? Because I think, which I'll go on to talk about later, when we talk about it, especially looking at, you know, from a conservative view or from a progressive view, we all have different ideas around what it looks like to be working towards welfare of our country, creating policies around that, right? So because of the fact that we have differing ideas and views, I feel like they kind of create a definition or create a framework for us to kind of understand it so that we can still kind of hold our different ideas at the same time and, you know, work together essentially to kind of come up with different concepts, you know. So I'm saying this to say that I don't think that in them creating this book, they're saying this is the only way you can think about this. I think they do a pretty good job of kind of giving you an overview of what things look like, what they could look like, you know, give examples of some of the things that have worked and what aren't working and some of the critiques of things, so you can kind of come up with your own ideas around social welfare and policy, right? And so I do like that. I thought another important thing to know is, like, they do say that another reason why they create this book is because they do recognize that it's very important for those who are professionals, so that includes like social workers, who are going to be working in spaces where policy is going to dictate a lot of what they can and can't do, to have an understanding of like how policies are formulated, why they're formulated, how they're carried out, who benefits, and all these different things. And they particularly point out that, you know, we have to know this stuff because a good portion of our work and our energy and our resources kind of go to this concept of direct services. And for us in social work, direct services essentially means that you're going to be in constant contact and communication with clients that you're helping, and then kind of connecting them to services and resources as they need. So that might look like making referrals to different services, doing case management, or trying to figure out if they're eligible for programs, or you might be providing like counseling and mediation for the person or their family. So because we are doing a lot of this direct service work, we have to be aware of how the policies that are out and that are available kind of affect how we can do these things for our patients, right? And so one example that they do bring up in the mental health field, which social workers sometimes end up being therapists and work in mental health, they brought up the reality that a few years ago, I think in the mid-1970s, they said that because policy and, you know, our government kind of ended up deinstitutionalizing a lot of mentally ill patients or individuals, it kind of reduced the need for inpatient hospitals and for social services to happen in that capacity. And it kind of shifted the need for community-based services. So now in our current day, what you kind of see if you are in the mental health space is that, you know, there's a greater need of not just providing patients with like direct counseling, but also try to help them figure out like housing, healthcare, income support, other social service programs, just to kind of help these, you know, patients survive everyday life or like deal with their everyday life, right? And kind of become or remain, I guess, their version of a full functioning adult, you know? And so I think I had to think about this in my current context, for example, where I work in an inpatient facility, because we have a lot of patients who are chronically mentally ill a lot of the times. So they're maybe dealing with schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder. And because of their illnesses, they can't work a full-time job, even if they want to, because of what's going on. We've not only have to try to connect psychiatric care and therapy services, sometimes we also have to help figure out placement. So if it might look like connecting them with a resource that works specifically with their population to help them make sure they can secure housing, make sure that they're following up with their meds, making sure that they're applying for Social Security benefits if that's something that they need. And so, yeah, so that's just an example of how, like, because of how policy and decisions are made from the top, it kind of affects what we can do from the bottom, you know, or from the local level, you know. And again, that's just one area. There's so many other areas, right? So if, as a social worker, if I'm not aware of how the different policies affect my patients or affects what I can do for my patients, I'm not going to be an effective social worker, and I will not be able to really provide what I can provide for my patients or direct them to the services that are available to my patients. And obviously, I think the tricky thing about policy and stuff is it's constantly changing. And, you know, there's constantly something that comes up that you have to be aware of and make sure that you're helping your patients be aware of as well. But I think that's the reality of understanding our society. And you just have to kind of go with the flow and, you know, do your best to keep up with things as much as possible. So with that said, I'm going to dive into a little bit more about what the book goes into after he makes his opening arguments and kind of give us a little bit of a, you know, thesis statement around this is what this book is going to be about or what we're going to try to do. So from chapter one, he starts by kind of giving an overview of social welfare policy, kind of using, you know, these political and analytical perspectives from an institutional level. And so the institutional perspective that he kind of identifies in the book, there's six of them. They look at structures like family, religious groups, the workplace, the market, civil society, and the government. And they kind of say, like, these are the six structures that are kind of helping to shape policy and the different helping activities in the United States. And so he kind of points out all the these different structures and what they do and why they're important. And then from there, he goes into talking about the modern welfare state. And he kind of argues that that's kind of like the embodiment of government social protection. And so they kind of go into describing the evolution of the welfare state in different stages. So first they look at the inception, like how did it like come up? How did it start? Growth, maturation, like how it's matured, transformation, and areas of duress or areas where there's been issues. And this is kind of all done looking at the progressive and the conservative perspective. From there, he goes into covering different types of benefits that are available in the social welfare structure, eligibility issues regarding like public versus nonprofit versus commercial services, funding. So like basically looking at how are all these social programs and benefits kind of paid for from like all the different levels of government. So like federal, state, local, how is everything paid for? And then he also kind of hits on some of the social and economic forces that are currently changing social welfare policy making. And so in doing all of these different things, the author uses a lot of stats, examples, you know, case studies, et cetera, to kind of help make some of his points. And I think, again, there's so much to try to capture in a book that's only a few hundred pages, but they do their best to kind of give you a general overview. And obviously, there's always room to dive into a topic deeper if there's something that they bring up that you're like, ooh, this is interesting. Let me look more into it, right? And so, yeah, so that's basically a general overview of the book, okay? And so when you kind of look at some of the things that stood out to me, one of the things at first I thought was important to kind of understanding welfare as a whole thing, I like that, you know, he does take some time at some point of the book to kind of define welfare state, also kind of help us to understand like the goals of the welfare state, and then kind of introduce like some of the traditional models of it, and then some of the more like institutional views or like some of the later views of it. And so I think, you know, obviously one of the most important things to kind of look at is like, how do we even define welfare? Because I know growing up, the topic of welfare was always seen as like a negative thing, as a bad thing. Like if you're on welfare, oh, there's something wrong with that. So I first, as I was reading this book again, I was like, you know, it would be helpful to have a kind of a definition of what we're saying when we're talking about welfare. And so first I wanted to look at like the Webster's Dictionary version. And it's like kind of saying like, the state of being happy, healthy, or successful. And I know for me, I guess I tend to lean a little bit more progressive, but I also tend to lean a little bit more towards like, how can we help people as a collective and not just people, the individual? And so when I see welfare, I'm like, yes, I think this should be something that we should strive for all levels of society, whoever you are, like, how can we help you be happy, healthy, and successful? And not in the sense of like, you have those three things because you're oppressing another group to get that, but you're getting that, you know, happiness or wealth or successful or whatever it is by working together with other people to kind of help everybody get that. And again, happiness and health and success is never going to be the same thing for everybody, but at least we're trying to create ways for us to do that in a way that's not hurting other people. And so I guess when I think about welfare, that's kind of how I look at it. And I think for part of this book, there are some groups of people that kind of look at it too that same way. But then obviously there's other people, other views of how you look at welfare, right? And so from there, I thought it was interesting to also think about government, because I think when we think about the welfare and welfare state, a lot of the times, like, there's this assumption that the government is going to take care of us, right? And so because of that, I thought it was also important to kind of think about how are we defining government as an institution. And I thought it was interesting that they used this definition from the Encyclopedia of Social Sciences, where they said that governmental institutions deal with the control of the use of force within society and the maintenance of internal and external peace, as well as control for mobilization of resources for the implementation of various goals and the articulation and setting up of certain goals for the collectivity. And I think this definition is very interesting because I think, like, the idealistic side of me, when I see this, I'm like, yeah, like, we should be using the government as a way to really, you know, maintain peace, help other people, contribute to them being healthy and happy and successful. But I think when we even look at what the government is doing in the current day, yes, they're using control and they're moving resources, but oftentimes it's at the expense of other people, other countries, and all these different things. So I think it's also good to kind of think about that. It's like, what is the ideal of the government? What are we currently doing? So that kind of made me think about that as well. And so from there, I thought it was cool that they kind of talked about how governmental welfare kind of became a thing. And so what they highlight is that, you know, obviously in the 1930s, there was the Great Depression. And before the Great Depression happened, anytime, you know, people were helping other people and trying to basically encourage a state of welfare, right? Or the good of others, whatever, that usually happened as a result of, like, family chipping in, religious groups or churches kind of chipping in, maybe sometimes some economic institution like banks or whatever. But ultimately, I feel like it was more described as a sense of, like, voluntary mutual aid, or maybe the local government will kind of deal with some of the stuff, right? But because of the Great Depression happening, obviously, people started noticing, like, the local government and all these different institutions were having a hard time really managing the crisis. And so from there, they kind of asked the federal government to kind of intervene and help out on, like, a nationwide level. And so this is what the authors kind of look at and describe as a shift from, like, the residual model of social welfare to, like, a more institutional one. And so with the traditional model or the residual view, they're kind of saying that that kind of looks at social welfare as, like, not a significant societal institute, but kind of something that is, like, a supplemental activity that's necessary when, like, the normal helping channels don't work or, like, they fail. So, like, again, these normal helping channels look like the family, the church, anything that's kind of used to kind of encourage mutual aid and local government stuff, right? So if those normal things don't work, then we kind of jump into social welfare things, right? And with this view, people that like to look at this view, they kind of see this as, like, a temporary response to, like, the failures of individuals and or major institutions, you know, those institutions that I mentioned. And so because of them seeing it as, like, a temporary thing, oftentimes social welfare is kind of seen as, like, something that's, like, undesirable or expendable, right? And I think, you know, a lot of people, especially I know, for example, me growing up in the Christian tradition, when we think about welfare, we think about programs like this, like, we often think of it as, like, oh, like, they must have failed, like, morally, or they must have failed as a person, and that's why they need these programs. But as you go on more into this book and you read about what is actually a part of these governmental programs, there's a lot of it that I think can be a good thing to have as a backup or like as a safety net, right? And that's where the authors kind of talk about the more institutional view of social welfare, where basically it sees social welfare as like a distinct pattern of activity that kind of like serves not only just like as a safety net to catch people that are struggling from social issues, but also kind of seen as like a integral or like a normal first line of defense or a function for society. So in other words, like, you know, this is like a basic social institute that we need to have, and it shouldn't have any stigma to it. It shouldn't be seen as like, oh, there's something wrong with this person for accepting this. Instead, there should be seen as like a primary means by which like individuals, families, and communities and everybody can kind of fulfill their social needs, right? And so for me, when I was thinking about this, I kind of looked at an example of like, especially the institutional view as like, for example, sex education, right? Obviously, you know, this country has their feelings on sexual education. And especially, I know, given this past few months, the Roe versus Wade stuff has been coming up repeatedly, right? And so for me, when I think about the institutional view, rather, I look at sex education as a thing that if we had it as a basic tenet of our society, you know, we wouldn't have to worry so much about needing certain programs because people would know how to be assertive, how to use protection, how to avoid STDs, how to, you know, protect themselves, how to practice safer sex. I personally know this is a huge leap to say, but I even personally think like abortions in a sense wouldn't have to be as high in some ways because, you know, you're having conversations about these things ahead of time and you're preparing yourself. And you, especially for like, I think about my work that I did with children who were at risk for foster care and stuff. Like when we were talking to them about sex, like it was uncomfortable because it, for me, like that wasn't something we talked about at home. So like talking to 13 to 18 year olds about sex, obviously is not a comfortable thing all the time, right? But because we talked to these little kids about this stuff early, a lot of them didn't feel like they had to engage in risky behaviors because they knew what to expect. They didn't feel peer pressure. And even when they did engage in those behaviors, they were doing it safely. So it kind of reduced the likelihood of like unwanted pregnancies in some way. It reduced the likelihood of catching a disease or just even feeling like this, the pressure of like, I need to have sex with my partner because that's the only way they're going to love me type of thing. And I know for me, especially as a woman, I found like having those conversations like with these kids were probably so freeing because I wish that there were people that had those conversations with me or like even some of my peers that I could feel open and honest about sex, that I didn't, that there didn't have to be this pressure that if I'm not doing this, then there's something wrong with me or whatever, you know? And I think obviously another example that I think I'm going to put a little bit about it in the show notes if you want to continue to read about this was because of what happened with the Great Depression. Eventually, we had President Roosevelt who came up with the New Deal and it kind of created some more permanent or institutional type social welfare programs, right? That ended up being very beneficial, you know? So, you know, even though at first it might have maybe been looked at something where you just quickly are trying to fix a problem, right? Because of what he did, he was able to kind of create something long-term where, you know, eventually they had federal programs for the unemployed. They were able to come up with the National Labor Relations Act, where they essentially created some unions, the idea of unions and all these things for people that were basically being treated unfairly at work, right? And then also the Social Security Act became a thing, which eventually kind of guaranteed pensions for millions of Americans, right? And so although I understand the desire to like not necessarily have people just solely depend on government aid, right? I think when we think about the first definition, it's hard to not be turned off by it because, of course, like you're creating stigma and all these different, you know, harsh realities for people that doesn't really account for the realities of like greed, uneven distribution of power, white supremacy, patriarchy, all the phobias from homophobia, transphobia. Like, it's not understanding like the system of oppression that are in power, you know, and that are running, you know. And so with that in mind, I think I like the author's definition and understanding of the welfare state and why it's kind of needed, because essentially the welfare state is kind of any governmental activities that are intended to kind of modify the play of the market forces to improve the well-being of citizens not able to manage on their own. Right. And again, I think because we have this horrible thing of like the American dream and capitalism and having to, you know, fight for everything and fuck anybody that can't make it. Because we have that mindset, I think the idea of caring for other people's welfare is such a hard thing to grasp and deal with. But I think it's something that is so important for us to consider. And I also would say, like, I think we are really big at like polarizing, and it's like it's only traditional view or it's only institutional view. But I think, like, you know, understanding, at least from my understanding of how these two views kind of work, I don't think it has to be a this or that thing. I think there can be situations where we look more at the, you know, traditional or residual stuff. Like, there's things that, you know, are kind of necessary for like temporary relief or temporary health, you know, but then at the same time, there's other things in policy that we can have as like a safety net, like automatically, like this can be something that everybody has. So like, for example, healthcare, like that should be something that everybody can have access to. And it doesn't have to be like a temporary help, right? But then maybe something that's like a temporary help that we don't make people feel bad about is like, if something happens at work and you need some extra help because you fell or you hurt yourself, right? I mean, for example, I know disability, sometimes you might need long term, that's, which is fine. But there's some programming, for example, that's maybe like short term. So like looking at something like that, like, again, it doesn't have to be only this or that kind of thing. Both things can exist at the same time. And I think that's something that we often don't consider when we have these conversations. So besides the definition of the welfare state, I thought it was cool that they kind of talk about some of the goals. And so they talk about the pillars of the welfare state. So there's like three goals, obviously, here. So the first goal is economic security. Second goal is materials efficiency. Third goal is basic services. And then from there, they kind of explain the policies and who benefits from it. And so with the first goal, economic security, this kind of looks at ways that you can protect citizens from common life risks by replacing lost income. So some of the policies that kind of fall into this is like Social Security, social insurance against illness, unemployment, disability, retirement, death of a spouse. And some of these obviously, you know, aren't long term. Some of them are, like, so, but for example, retirement, once you're retired. So those would be a little long. Obviously, people pass away, so it's not that long term, but it's a little longer than if you need like unemployment, for example, because maybe unemployment, you're on it for a few months or a few years until you get yourself back together and you can get back to work. And so, you know, that might be seen something that's a little bit more temporary, right? And so people that can benefit from this, obviously, is the working population, retirees, and their and families and their dependents. So that's for the first one, economic security. So the second one, materials efficiency, this kind of looks at ways that you can provide a basic floor of social protection. So this policies that kind of fall into this is like public assistance, cash relief, and social services. And again, this kind of benefits the poor and a disadvantaged. And this is another thing where when we talk about the this or that type of situation, right? This might be something that you have, like, again, that can be kind of temporary until people who are impoverished can kind of, I don't want to say like work their way out of it, because that's, our society makes it hard to do that sometimes, but hopefully it can be something that can be more temporary, hopefully, right? And once they have like get more access to certain things, it could be something that potentially that they can get out of, right? But again, because our society is kind of skewed, unfortunately, some of these policies may last longer. But again, I think if we had like, again, like a universal, like institutional view of social welfare, a lot of those things wouldn't have to happen. Because when we get to the third one, basic services looks at ensuring access to critical goods and services. And that applies to like all citizens. So when we're looking at the basic services, that looks at education, healthcare, housing, and nutrition. So my argument here in saying what I said a few seconds ago is, if we are making sure that people have access to education, healthcare, housing, and nutrition, we probably wouldn't have to put so much effort into public assistance, cash relief, and some of these other things that are out there, because people can have more access and opportunity to do other things if that's what they wanted. And I also say this with the knowledge that not everybody can go to college. Not everybody's wired for that, right? But of course, even like looking at what are some other educational things that we can come up with that includes everybody. So if it's, you know, vocational things, if it's like trade schools, like how can we encourage people to have access to educational things that can actually help them in the way that they're wired, instead of just being like, oh, if you can't afford to go to college and pay these, you know, big universities all this money or take out student loans, then you don't have a shot of anything, right? And I'll probably talk about education system stuff later. And even I will critique the hell out of being in social work and social nonprofits eventually too on this podcast. But I think, you know, if we're not thinking about the intentions of how we're using social welfare and how we can use it to the benefit of everybody else, you know, we kind of miss opportunities to make our society stronger and better. And so for me, that's why I like that they really break down, like, what is welfare? What is the welfare state? Because oftentimes it's, I think we get like very negative connotation or negative thoughts about these words and what these things mean. But then I know for me as a social worker, when I'm working with some of my patients, they're pissed that they can't get access to unemployment, or they're pissed that they haven't been able to get access to disability. But it's like, yeah, but if we're continuing to vote in ways that don't create ways for you guys to get into those programs without this huge fight, and then we're going to be here. We're going to be stuck. Every time you're going to talk to me, I'm going to have to tell you, sorry, the state of Florida is limited, or sorry, this other state is limited, right? Because we're not challenging the stigmas and all the things that come with having these programs when we all will need them at some point. And that's also, for me, I challenge people to think more about, don't push for these programs or push for these resources only when your family needs it, because you never know when your family can fall into these situations. So again, I work in inpatients. Nobody an inpatient or nobody's family that their family member is an inpatient, you know, is going to be like, oh yes, one day when my son turns 28, he's going to, you know, be schizophrenic, and, you know, he's going to have all these acute symptoms, and he's not going to be able to work, and I'm going to need this resource, so that's why I'm going to vote. Nobody thinks like that, right? Everybody thinks they're immune to having stuff happening to them until there's a moment where shit really goes south and something happens to them. And then now we're crying and wondering, why can't I have access to resources? But it's like, we never created ways to prepare ourselves for that. We're investing in things that don't really allow us to prepare for things like that to happen. So again, I don't bring up policy and all this stuff to like sit on a particular political platform or anything like that, but it's also just to encourage us to really think about the things that we need and the things that we invest in, because if not, it really bites you in the end. And I will also say, last thing, thinking on this topic is, even like when you think about now, there's been a really big like opioid and drug epidemic and all this stuff for all these myriad of reasons. People are struggling with alcoholism and drugs and all this stuff, right? And a lot of the times now, because we're pushing so hard to capitalize on this issue and people are privatizing their facilities, I have so many patients that come in, no insurance, no access to money, because unfortunately, addiction sometimes means you lose your job, you don't have insurance, you don't have access to resources, right? And so when they're like, finally, like, man, I hit rock bottom and I want to detox, I know where I live in the state of Florida, there's probably like one or two options, and there's like a huge ass waiting list for that to happen. If not, you're paying millions of dollars or like thousands of dollars to get into a facility, unless you have let's say you're old enough that you're still on your parents' insurance maybe, and they can help you, or you happen to be on disability for something else. You know what I mean? So again, I think it's something that's important to think about, because it's not like, again, you're like, oh, one day my son is going to be addicted to opioids and now I can invest in this just in case. Like, we don't think about the realities that that stuff can happen to us or our families until we're in the situation. We're like, shit, there's no resources, right? So I think it's so important, again, to plan ahead and not just think about, oh, this will never happen to me, screw the person that this happens to, type of thing. Because I think we think like that a lot. But instead, plan ahead and be like, how can we create safety nets so if stuff like this does happen, we can be there, right? And how can we even prevent, like, do preventative stuff to prevent some of this stuff from happening? So from there, I kind of wanted to hit on something that I thought was interesting is how they talked about the political perspectives of this. So kind of looking at the conservative versus progressive views. I think for me, as I'm looking at these views, I want us to kind of like separate faith from this, you know, situation and even some of the stuff going on with our current political climate, because at this point, I feel like both of them are kind of bleeding into each other, and it's not a clear line of like, one is being progressive and one is being whatever. I mean, people can vary on that opinion, but to me, I feel like it's like the same side of the shit coin. Like, they both are steeped in white supremacy, but whatever. That's my opinion. But if we separate, you know, the faith part of this, when we look at the conservative perspective, the author kind of notes that they focus more on like individualism, social problems reflect bad choices, personal dysfunction, culture of poverty, and unregulated markets and private property are what they think ensure the prosperity and welfare of the country. When they look at the government, they kind of focus more on the residual view. So basically, the government should be small. So that, in other words, like, they should be very modest and decentralized and kind of be an adjunct to the private institutions. So like, you know, religious, family, all that stuff like we talked about before. And so for them, they could focus more on relying on market, voluntary, and religious arrangements. And then the social policy to them should aim to kind of provide a minimum safety net focused on the poor only. So that's an interesting way to look at it, obviously. And then for when we look at the progressive side, there's more focus on collectivism. So social problems reflect a fundamental socioeconomic circumstances, barriers to access, lack of opportunity. And when I say, I should clarify, socioeconomic is looking at like your financial background, like in terms of like how much you make and stuff like that, and where you are in society on like on a hierarchy, essentially. I think that's like the best way I can explain it for layman's terms. But again, we look at, they kind of say like also that the unregulated market kind of creates dangerous economic circles, unemployment, urban blight, poverty, inequality, and environmental issues. And then they kind of take more of the institutional perspective. So they think like government should be large enough to advance social welfare on the behalf of the broad community. They really rely on public leadership. They try to provide broad program coverage to ensure full opportunity, economic security, and the basic social goods. So there's a lot there to unpack, but in short, conservatives are kind of suspicious of government action. The book kind of notes that, you know, while Ronald Reagan on several occasions kind of stated the best thing the government can do is nothing, conservatives rarely reject the worth of public action completely. They kind of spend money on like military, public roads, basic education, you know, a structure of law to force rules of fair play. But when it comes to like social welfare, conservatives kind of are resistant to that. And they basically are like, nope, minimum safety net that is required to protect social order. And that's it. So like, they kind of see government action as such as welfare as something that's kind of undermining personal responsibility and kind of stopping the marketplace from being the way that it needs to be, right? And so this rationale was seen in 1935 when Republican opposition to Social Security basically said that people should be responsible to plan for their own futures, but they're not going to do that if automatically they're going to have some retirement income, right? And then we kind of see this rationale still kind of used today when we talk about the welfare state. So like the author is basically saying here, a lot of the times when we talk about the welfare state, people are like, no, like as a individual, you need to be responsible for your own shit. And that's it, you know? And I think this is a very interesting take. I mean, A, given that a lot of conservatives tend to say that they profess, you know, that they follow God and they care about loving others and blah, 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 blah. But then also, a lot of the time, people can't really ever make enough money to, like, you know, pay for retirement all the time because they're living paycheck to paycheck. So it's not like they're being lazy and just expecting the government to give them a handout in a sense. It's just, it's hard. It's so if our society was built in a way that people could easily like plan for their retirement and work and they can have a guaranteed like way of saving something, then yeah, I would understand if you oppose that a little bit more. But I think, you know, I'm even thinking about in today's day and age how you see nice little old men and women still working in their like 60s and 70s when they should be chilling. You know, some of them have worked hard enough, or a lot of them have worked hard enough. They lived it long enough, in my opinion, too. So again, I personally don't have a problem of like thinking about, you know, taking care of the elderly and stuff. I think also because I come from a tradition or like a background where immigrants, we just take care of our elders. We don't see it as a burden, but you know, whatever, America has its views. So there's that. And then on the other hand, progressives kind of see the mission of the government as a way to kind of balance market balance the market forces and kind of modify power, especially of those of the elite, to kind of move in favor of the whole. And so then in their view, doing this kind of thing ensures that there's going to be economic growth, fair employment, fair wages, economic security, all the things that we kind of talked about. So in this view or this understanding, progressive kind of stress, you know, active public responsibility to guarantee that all basic human needs are addressed. And so in practice, when you look at progressive social policies, they kind of base everything that they do on like social justice ethics. And so they try to do their best to kind of advance the allocation of resources to help reduce inequalities in our societies. And that can take form in a variety of different ways. But most of the things that we've mentioned before is like in education, health, housing, and things like that. So again, coming from the Christian perspective, it's weird to me to see that we're so against the progressive view. And I do think it's unfortunate that, you know, we kind of use these tickets of like, you know, abortion and gay rights to tack them on just to the conservative idea and then say, oh, well, that's the Christian view. I don't understand that, but sure, because again, like if we take religion out of this altogether, I think if you're a person of any faith, you know, that values love, charity, and loving other people, the progressive view should be the place that we go to, yes, we can have arguments or discussions around maybe like how we do the policies, that I can understand that. But ultimately, like, caring for the whole and caring for everybody should be important, regardless of if they believe the same things that you do. But again, I know I'm different on that, but, you know, I just thought it was interesting to kind of look at this from, I guess, like a social work perspective, how they, or even how they bring it up in this book of policy. But again, I kind of had to separate the religious crap from it, because I think if you look at it for what it was intended to be, the conservative and progressive view, again, as a believer, I think you would more than likely fall into the progressive stuff. But again, that's not me. And then even with that, I would almost say like conservatism or being conservative should almost be like renamed to like America First or something else. Because again, as the book kind of notes, like, it's not like you're not really using government action. You're using it for other stuff. Because I feel like when I think about the word conservative, it means like you don't want to use government at all, right? Or like you're limiting it. But it's like, it's not that we're really limiting. Like, you're using the government for things that you care about and the things that really continue to just make America a bigger and badder country that can take over other countries or like hurt people, essentially. It's not really that we're not putting money into shit. It's just what we're putting the money into. So I guess even with the name conservative and progressive, I feel like there could even be some shifts in how we change that, if that makes sense, right? And again, with same as like when we look at the residual and institutional view, I don't think being conservative or progressive in certain things need to necessarily be an or type of thing. I think you can have both exist. So maybe there's some areas that we're a little bit more conservative about. There's some areas you could be more progressive about, right? And maybe you don't spend as much money in some areas, like, you know, and maybe you spend some more money in some other stuff, right? But again, I don't think, you know, looking at our government as a way to promote individualism and not care for the welfare of our whole country is like a good move, in my opinion. And so I know for me, as a person that's had to think more about taxes, that's been a hard one, especially since I was working in Chicago for a bit, and I had to think about, wow, I'm paying a state tax, because Florida, there's not a state tax. And in paying state taxes, there's a good chunk of state taxes in Chicago that goes towards dealing with the corruption and paying back families for lawsuits for things for, like, you know, police brutality. I know there's this nonprofit that I learned about that they created it essentially because a police officer there was like waterboarding and making people like confess to things that they didn't do. And because of that, they essentially created a whole nonprofit to help deal with that, like help families recover from that and help families, you know, have access to education and like basically find ways to pay back these families for the bullshit that this man did. And so for me, I'm like, you know, we think about how we're using our tax money, if we're focusing so much on, you know, military and all this other stuff, and I do see police almost as military too. So if we think about, we're putting stuff into police, we're putting stuff into military, we're putting stuff into just maintaining power and status quo, and that's it, instead of looking at preventative things and other ways to like help our society function well, like education, you know, safe roads and all these other things that can also help alleviate the stuff that the police officers also would have to deal with, right? If we're just focusing on that shit, then it's like all of our tax money is going to end up going into lawsuits and paying back shit when if we would end up spending less on preventative stuff. And again, that's my opinion. But as I was like thinking about this and where my tax money is going, it kind of sucks, you know, when you think about it, because instead we could be investing in like training police officers better, dealing with institutional racism, you know, providing education for sex. Like, there's so many things that we could be doing to prevent the issues that we're not doing, but then we're investing in other stuff to kind of like treat the symptoms instead. And so we end up spending more money on treating the symptoms and actually addressing what's happening. And I will venture to say that that's kind of done by design because LOL America, but I don't know. Again, having to pay state taxes and having to think more about policy and where money is actually going and what it's actually doing, you know, it makes somebody think, right? And it's almost, as I was thinking about this podcast, it kind of reminded me of like how at church, when you're putting money into the envelope to give to church, you kind of have that option to allocate the money somewhere. So for a lot of us, it would be so nice if we can have that option to be like, nope, we're not putting it into this. We wanted to put it into here. Because I think if we even had that option, a lot of us would probably feel a little bit better about having to give up our taxes every year. Because I know for me, every year, I'm just like, damn it. Like, this is rough. So especially if you're black or brown and you're like, it feels like you're paying for your own execution sometimes because of like how this country treats us. It just, again, it really makes you think. Yeah, so I really did like this book. Again, there's so many different things that they tackle. For the sake of time, I'm like, those were the two big things that I really wanted to talk about. And lastly, like, they really talked about eligibility, because I know as a kid, talking about poverty and people that were on the streets and stuff, it's always stigmatized, right? But nobody ever talked about, like, you know, what happened to the people that were on these streets? Why weren't they getting benefits? Who were actually getting benefits? And again, I think welfare and talking about government programs is always like stigmatized. So I like that the book even brought up the fact that a lot of the times people who have access or should have access to resources are not even really taking the resources because of the fact that it's so stigmatized. So then again, it kind of makes you wonder, where is this money going? You know, what are we doing with the money if these programs are here, but people aren't even using them, right? But then also, like, why can't we work to kind of encourage more people to use these things and not stigmatize them? So I do like that he kind of talks about that when we talk about, you know, eligibility and who's actually, like, having that access, because again, those are things that we need to talk about if we want to actually have a fair conversation about policy. And so, you know, again, I really like this book. I think one of the ways that it really challenged me or made me think differently is that it really forced me to kind of look at the ideas of like equality and equity. Because I think a lot of times when we talk about equality, of course, everybody's like, oh, I don't want everybody to get something that I had to work so hard for and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, whatever. And again, the fact that I hear that from Christians is always ugh, to me, but whatever. Because if you think about it, you know, if we believe in our scriptures and all that, God gave us all equal rights to get to know him, even though we didn't deserve it. So, you know, chew on that for a minute. But yeah, but it's just interesting to hear. But I did like that the book kind of explained the ideas of equality and equity and kind of helped break down the realities that, you know, they don't necessarily mean the same things. And kind of thinking about like equality meaning that each individual obviously is going to have the same resources and the same opportunities. But when we look at equity, we're recognizing that each person has a different circumstance and different access to like resources and opportunities. And so they need a little bit more help sometimes to have an equal outcome, you know? And so I did find a resource that did a really good job of just explaining the difference. And so they gave examples, and the example that I was going to use to kind of explain the two. So equality is basically when a city cuts the budget and for like 25 community centers by reducing the operational hours for all centers by the same amount at the same time. So that's an example of equality. But when we look at equity, then the city still kind of has to make adjustments to the centers, but the way that they do it is they determine which times and how many hours each community actually needs so that they can have their community centers open. And so they kind of reduce the hours that aren't being used as frequently for each of these different centers, right? So it's doing it in fairness at the end of the day, right? And so obviously there's a lot that can be said about equality and equity. But again, it made me have to think a little bit more about the realities of like what people have to deal with. I think it also challenged the idea of the American dream for me, because I think our whole lives were told, like, if you work hard enough, you go to school, you do X, Y, and Z, if you're self-reliant, you know, you're going to be successful, you're going to be rewarded X, Y, and Z. But again, if we look at the reality of, like, oppression and all these different structures, unless equity happens, like, that's not true. You're not going to be successful. It doesn't matter how self-reliant and how hard you work. Sometimes you're not going to be successful because of all the different structures that are kind of against you, right? And so again, that's why it's so important to kind of look at equity and try to figure out ways that we can serve our communities and kind of encourage these things to happen within our communities with that idea in mind, right? And so yeah, so I really enjoyed reading this book. Like I said, especially since I'm an immigrant, there was a lot of stuff here that I was exposed to that I had to think about that I never had on my radar. And I think it also became very important for me to have a lot of these thoughts kind of presented to me and challenge some of my thinking, because I know growing up in like a predominantly white space, I was very brainwashed into like the American dream mindset. You have to keep pushing and chugging or else, you know, there's something that you're doing wrong and it's a personal thing and blah, blah, blah. And so like, I think this book kind of started opening me up to the ideas around like, how can we look at things collectively? And I think, you know, at the end of the day, it didn't really take me that much pushing to lean me towards that direction, because I feel like Haitian culture is very community minded for the most part. And my family's pretty community minded for the most part. But again, it kind of helped me deconstruct some of the bullshit that I was fed as a kid and challenge some of the oppressive things that I was like buying into. And obviously, I still have a lot more work to do and there's still a lot to learn. I think, you know, as I was revisiting this book, I was reminded of that. I was like, oh shit, there's still so much that I have to learn. But again, I think the reason why I like this book and the reason why I would recommend books like this is because we really have to make sure that before we're talking about policy and we're having conversations about welfare and what it means and why we should do this or that, and why people deserve this or that, we need to really understand the terminology and how it really is going to be applied in the long run and what are the implications of the way that we think and vote and, you know, carry on or apply these different policies. And again, this stuff should be an ongoing conversation because things are constantly changing. We're evolving, we're learning, hopefully. So none of this is going to stay the same. But again, I think it's so important to really take time to learn policy, even if it's not like this book, because I know there's stuff in this book that can be challenging for people to read, or like you might have to be like, let me find a thesaurus so I can follow along with these people. But you know, start small. If you need to find another policy book that, you know, breaks it down into like smaller levels and really help you understand, start there and then work your way up and just kind of, again, get the basics and do your best to kind of challenge yourself to continue to learn and grow as you go on these issues. And so yeah, with that said, I thank you guys so much for joining me on this episode of Critical Reads, episode 4. Again, sorry that it was late, but you know, this is going to be the reality. Like I said, there's going to be some weeks we're going to be perfect. We can make it work on Friday. There's going to be some weeks, it might be Saturday, right? But ultimately, like I said, I just want to continue to provide a space for you all to just reflect on things, kind of learn and grow, and again, ask questions. So as I leave you, I will remind you that you can always feel free to connect with me on my social medias, which will be talked about in the outro, or you can email me at connect@soulsessionswithneff.com. That email address will be in the show notes so you can see how everything is spelled. But don't be afraid to reach out, ask questions, and just connect with me. I love to like learn and grow with you as we're going through this process. And so again, thank you all for joining me, and I look forward to hanging out with you guys and talking through another book next week. Hey there, and thank you for joining me on this week's episode of Critical Reads. To find out more about me or to consume more of my content, please feel free to visit my website, soulsessionswithneff.com, where I share a variety of things, including blog posts, resource lists, and have a regularly updated calendar for this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook using the handle at Soul Sessions with Neff. While you're at it, if you really enjoy listening to Critical Reads, I encourage you to please subscribe to this show on iTunes, Google, or Spotify, and take some time to rate us on these different platforms. Your reviews will really help the show gain some visibility and also give me some much needed feedback on how the show is doing. I thank you in advance for your time and your support. And until next time, this has been Neff with some Critical Reads.